both of them were waiting and practically carried her inside. They took her cane, her bag, her coat, and walked her slowly to their favorite table, which they'd moved closer to the fireplace. They brought her coffee and water and offered anything else she could possibly want. It was mid-afternoon. The lunch crowd was gone. Francesca and her student had Nino's to themselves. When Marco arrived a few minutes later, the two brothers greeted him like family. "La professoressa la sta aspettando," one of them said. "The teacher is waiting." The fall on the gravel at San Luca and the sprained ankle had transformed her. Gone was the frosty indifference. Gone was the sadness, at least for now. She smiled when she saw him, even reached up, grabbed his hand, and pulled him close so they could blow air kisses at both cheeks, a custom Marco had been observing for 2 months but had yet to engage in. This was, after all, his first female acquaintance in Italy. She waved him to the chair directly across from her. The brothers swarmed around, taking his coat, asking him about coffee, anxious to see what an Italian lesson would look and sound like. "How's your foot?" Marco asked, and made the mistake of doing so in English. She put her finger to her lips, shook her head, and said, "Non inglese, Marco, solamente italiano." He frowned and said, "I was afraid of that." Her foot was very sore. She kept it on ice while she was reading or watching television, and the swelling had gone down. The walk to the restaurant had been slow, but it was important to move about. At her mother's insistence, she was using a cane. She found it both useful and embarrassing. More coffee and water arrived, and when the brothers were convinced that things were perfect with their dear friend Francesca and her Canadian student, they reluctantly retreated to the front of the restaurant. "How is your mother?" he asked in Italian. "Very well, very tired. She has been sitting with Giovanni for a month now, and it's taking a toll." So, thought Marco, Giovanni is now available for discussion. "How is he?" "Inoperable brain cancer," she said, and it took a few tries to get the translation right. "He has been suffering for almost a year, and the end is quite close. He is unconscious. It's a pity." "What was his profession? What did he do?" "He taught medieval history at the university for many years. They met there. She was a student. He was her professor. At the time, he was married to a woman he disliked immensely. They had 2 sons. She and her professor fell in love and began an affair which lasted almost 10 years before he divorced his wife and married Francesca." "Children?" "No," she said with sadness. "Giovanni had 2. He didn't want any more." She had regrets, many regrets. The feeling was clear that the marriage had not been a happy one. "Wait till we get around to mine," thought Marco. It didn't take long.
"Tell me about you," she said. "Speak slowly. I want the accents to be as good as possible."
"I'm just a Canadian businessman," Marco began in Italian.
"No, really. What's your real name?"
"No.
What is it?"
"For now, it's Marco. I have a long history, Francesca, and I can't talk about it."
"Very well. Do you have children?"
"Ah, yes." For a long time, he talked about his 3 children, their names, ages, occupations, residences, spouses, children. He added some fiction to move along his narrative, and he pulled off a small miracle by making the family sound remotely normal. Francesca listened intently, waiting to pounce on any wayward pronunciation or improperly conjugated verb. One of Nino's boys brought some chocolates and lingered long enough to say with a huge smile,
"Parla molto bene, signore."
"You speak very well, sir." She began to fidget after an hour, and Marco could tell she was uncomfortable. He finally convinced her to leave, and with great pleasure he walked her back down Via Menzoni, her right hand tightly fixed to his left elbow, while her left hand worked the cane. They walked as slowly as possible. She dreaded the return to her apartment, to the death watch, the vigil. He wanted to walk for miles, to cling to her touch, to feel the hand of someone who needed him. At her apartment, they traded farewell kisses and made arrangements to meet at Nino's tomorrow. Same time, same table. J.C. Hubbard spent almost 25 years in Washington, a quarter of a century of major league hell-raising with an astounding string of disposable women. The last had been May Sun, a beauty almost 6 feet tall with perfect features, deadly black eyes, and a husky voice that had no trouble at all getting J.C. out of a bar and into a car. After an hour of rough sex, she had delivered him to Sammy Tin, who finished him off, and left him at his brother's grave. When sex was needed to set up a kill, Sammy preferred May Sun. She was a fine MSS agent in her own right, but the legs and face added a dimension that had proved deadly on at least 3 occasions. He summoned her to Bologna, not to seduce, but to hold hands with another agent and pretend to be happily married tourists. Seduction, though, was always a possibility, especially with Backman. Poor guy had just spent 6 years locked up, away from women. May spotted Marco as he moved in a crowd down Strada Maggiore, headed in the general direction of Via Fondazza. With amazing agility, she picked up her pace, pulled out a cell phone, and managed to gain ground on him while still looking like a bored window shopper. Then he was gone. He suddenly took a left, turned down a narrow alley, Via Bagatto, and headed north away from Via Fondazza. By the time she made the turn, he was out of sight. Chapter 25. Spring was finally arriving in Bologna. The last flurries of snow had fallen. The temperature had approached 50 degrees the day before, and when Marco stepped outside before dawn, he thought about swapping his parka for one of the other jackets. He took a few steps under the dark portico, let the temperature sink in, then decided it was still chilly enough to keep the parka. He'd return in a couple of hours, and he could switch then if he wanted. He crammed his hands in his pockets and took off on the morning hike. He could think of nothing but the Times story. To see his name plastered across the front page brought back painful memories, and that was unsettling enough. But to be accused of bribing the president was actionable at law, and in another life, he would have started the day by shotgunning lawsuits at everyone involved. He would have owned the New York Times. But what kept him awake were the questions. What would the attention mean for him now? Would Luigi snatch him again and run away? And the most important, was he in more danger today than yesterday? He was surviving nicely, tucked away in a lovely city where no one knew his real name. No one recognized his face. No one cared. The Bolognese went about their lives without disturbing others. Not even he recognized himself. Each morning when he finished shaving and put on his glasses and his brown corduroy driver's cap, he stood at the mirror and said hello to Marco. Long gone were the fleshy jowls and puffy dark eyes, the thicker, longer hair. Long gone was the smirk and the arrogance. Now, he was just another quiet man on the street. Marco was living one day at a time, and the days were piling up. No one who read the Times story knew where Marco was or what he was doing. He passed a man in a dark suit and instantly knew he was in trouble. The suit was out of place. It was a foreign variety, something bought off the rack in a low-end store, one he had seen every day in another life. The white shirt was the same monotonous button-down he had seen for 30 years in D.C. He'd once considered floating an office memo banning blue and white cotton button-downs, but Carl Pratt had talked him out of it. He couldn't tell the color of the tie. It was not the type of suit you'd ever see under the porticos along Via Fondazza before dawn, or at any other time for that matter. He took a few steps, glanced over his shoulder and saw that the suit was now following him. White guy, 30 years old, thick, athletic, the clear winner in a foot race or a fist fight. So Marco used another strategy. He suddenly stopped, turned around and said, "You want something?" To which someone else said, "Over here, Backman." Hearing his